This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Miguel, can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
They all can hear us, so it might not be at our end, folks. Make sure your volume is up.
It's up, but you're a little muddled.
I am muddled. That's the truth of life.
I think it's because you're far from the whatever it is that's picking up the sound. If you need directional mics, I can maybe help for that in the future. Something on your bodies.
Okay, I'm going to get a directional mic and see if it's hot. Okay.
Make this work.
That's better.
It's better already?
Yes, I can hear you.
You're right next to the computer. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, now I can.
That's great.
That was...
Sorry. Thank you. It's great.
Now that we've gotten through the technical things, we're out of time. Let's go have lunch. I thought I'd start by saying a little bit about myself. Like Nenzen said, back in the 90s, I was a student of Kobun in Boulder. He was there at Naropa University. And there was something about his vulnerability and his authenticity that enchanted me. He was just himself all the time. And when I finally came to Jikoji a few years ago, for the first time, I felt that same enchantment. I felt like, oh, he's here. He's in the Sangha. So there is something so beautiful about it. And Mike Shoho, he and I have been practicing together since the early 90s. He was the officiant of my wedding in 1998. And that same just simple honesty of being So I wanted to take a little bit of time this morning to speak a little bit about as human beings, we all experience a deep kind of disconnection from our original sense of belonging in the world. You can see it in a young child who hasn't experienced this disconnection yet, that they move with so much ease in the world. And you can just tell that they have an experience that they belong. And at some point for all of us, something happens that breaks that experience of connection and belonging. It might be one thing, it might be several things. But for each of us, it's a truly heartbreaking event. And I wanted to speak about that because my experience of the Dharma path is that this is a path of returning to belonging, to connection. When I was in first grade, I lived, it was just my mom and I in an apartment in the city of Denver in Colorado, and a poor and somewhat dangerous neighborhood. And I didn't know it at the time, but my mom was very poor. We were very poor. At that age, that didn't have any meaning for me. And she worried about being able to pay the bills, about being able to feed us. One day she sent me to the local 7-Eleven. I learned later that we were in a food desert. Our food came from 7-Eleven because that was the only place where we could get it. She sent me to the 7-Eleven to get some bread and some butter and some eggs. I remember the shopping list very clearly because it was a moment in my life that was a line of demarcation between one experience of myself in the world and another. And I thought, when I got the groceries, and I thought, there's a little bit of extra money, I'll buy myself some candy. And then I just won't give her the receipt. And I was with a friend, and there was this little concrete embankment behind the 7-Eleven. And we took off our shoes and we slid down on our socks to the point where we actually got holes in our socks. It was fun. We were having a lot of fun. And I had just eaten candy, and I got home and gave my mom the groceries and the change. And she started to cry. And she took me out on the fire escape. And every penny mattered for us. And she said, I know that you took some of the money because I know exactly how much it cost. And she said, you hurt me. And I can remember feeling like, as a person, I was never going to be okay again in that moment. 6 years old. And I started to develop coping mechanisms to deal with the feeling of feeling disconnected, of not feeling like a part of the world anymore, of feeling separated, like I didn't belong, like an outsider. And I didn't realize it for a long time, but these coping mechanisms actually caused me to feel more separated from the world. And they were primarily in the domain of distraction. Like, I got really into reading novels, really into fiction. Later on, movies, television, video games. Distracting myself from this feeling of disconnection. And I imagine that other people here can relate, that we all have our version And sometimes when we're on the cushion, what arises is what Buddha spoke of as the first noble truth, suffering. And in fact, he spoke very directly as suffering in terms of us experiencing ourselves as distinct, separate, disconnected individuals. That in Buddhism, that is what suffering is. And another thing that I imagine we can all relate to together is that we have these strategies for how to cope, and that these strategies, when we examine them, actually cause us to experience greater disconnection. So the Dharma path is a path of courage, because it's a path of returning to the suffering. So in fact, it's actually a tremendous blessing if you're sitting on the cushion and you start to experience suffering. Because it means that you're returning. And this is our path, to return and to return and to return and to return, and then go away and then return and then go away and return. I had a teacher once say that practice is becoming intimate with this moment exactly as it is. Becoming intimate, intimate. I had another teacher say that Buddhism is can seem like kind of a downer for some people, because you know we always talk about suffering. So he was from the South, and he used to say, "Have you heard the good news of Buddhism? Have you heard the good news? Because there is good news, which is that when we return and embrace our experience exactly as it is, without trying to change it, without trying to have it be something different, then with patience, there's a way that in the process of witnessing, just witnessing, we can start to distinguish that our experience of it as good or bad is distinct from the experience itself. So I could be having an experience of anxiety. Which is a running a retreat center is a frequent experience for me. And historically, I would relate to it like a magnet. Either I'm drawn to an experience or I'm repulsed by it. Or maybe it's neutral and I don't really have a preference one way or another. And we tend to relate to these, you know, emotional states that we call suffering as bad. And yet, with practice, it's possible to distinguish between the experience and the feeling about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's not that either one goes away. You just discover, oh, those aren't the same thing. And a lot of space opens up in that place. What the Buddha called luminous ground of awareness. So, if you've heard the good news, there's a story of Shakyamuni Buddha, one of the original suttas, when he's practicing as an ascetic in the forest, and he has renounced everything. And he's practicing with a group of ascetics who have taken him as their teacher. And he's determined that the path towards liberation is to deny himself everything that he can, even to the point where he starts holding his breath to the edge of death. And he's sitting in this forest, emaciated, because he hasn't eaten. And he's thinking to himself as he holds his breath, perhaps if I hold my breath for a little bit longer, then I'll attain liberation. And at, you know, at the moment of probably right before he was going to die, he had this thought, and the thought was, might there be another way? Might there be another way? And what came to his mind was one of my favorite stories. Of Shakyamuni Buddha, he had a memory of sitting underneath a rose apple tree as a child. I don't know what a rose apple tree is, but it sounds beautiful. And his father was hosting a harvest festival, and he was on a hill sitting underneath a rose apple tree. And there was all of this celebration going on. He was very content. He was at peace. He didn't have a feeling like something needed to be different than it was. He was just a kid. Probably like I could imagine myself like turning a couple of sticks into cars and being like, you know, just being there. And so the answer that he had for himself was yes, there is another way. It's much simpler. It's just about being here. And belonging. Which is available always, right here. And then, of course, shortly after that, well, there was a young maiden who came with some rice milk, which was said to be kind of like the ice cream of the day. Very rich. And in fact, she had, if I remember the story correctly, she had a sister or her mother, somebody was dying, and she had gone to she had asked a deva how she could heal this family member. And the deva had said, take the milk of 1,000 cows and feed them to 100 cows, and then take the milk of those 100 cows and feed them to 10 cows, and then take the milk of those 10 cows and feed them to 1 cow, and take the milk of that cow and make rice milk and offer it to me, to this deva. So this woman was out in this forest with this rice milk looking for a deva. And she saw Sakyamuni Buddha sitting there on the verge of death and just was moved to offer him the rice milk instead. And he had just had this moment of remembering sitting under the rose apple tree as a child before he had had that break. And moving into an experience of feeling like he didn't belong. And so he accepted the rice milk. And his, you know, the other ascetics that he was with immediately were like, what the hell, man? We thought you were teaching us the way to liberation through, you know, denying ourselves everything. And he said, there's another way. And they thought, you know, they were really disappointed in him and left him. And so that's when he went and sat under the Bodhi tree, the place where he attained liberation. And in that last moment, perhaps the story that's most told, when he's beset by Mara, who's a demon that's filling him with temptation and doubt. And the final thing that he struggles with as he's sitting under this tree before attaining liberation is doubt. And in that moment of doubt, he touched the earth. It's called the Earth Witness. You can see a lot of Buddha statues. It's usually the palm facing out with the fingers touching the ground in front of the knee. You can look at Buddha statues. There are a lot of them. And that's the moment of liberation for Sakyamuni Buddha, called Earth Witness often. And it's usually defined as, I think always defined as the earth witnessing Sakyamuni's liberation, awakening. And in my own heart, I also carry that Sakyamuni was also witnessing the earth in that moment, that it was a reciprocal witness. And a full return to belonging, to connection. So I think I would say thank you everyone for being here, and I would invite you to consider to consider that we all do belong. Thank you. I suppose that that we want to, if there's time, open it to questions. Is there time? Yeah? And I think we can hear our friends online if you have questions, or you can put it in chat.
I appreciated your talk very much, in particular incorporating silence. And especially the end where you're unplanned in the moment. I'm curious because your instrument of speaking is very provocative to me.
Mm-hmm.
How long you've been giving these talks?
Mm-hmm.
Just out of my curiosity, and of course, probably talking a lot to yourself. After that.
Well, in my professional capacity, I speak a lot, but this is my first Dharma talk.
Thank you for that. You're giving your first Dharma talk to me.
Thank you. Yes.
Would you please say a little bit more about the idea of belonging. I think I know what it means, but I'm not sure about it in this context.
Yes. There's in fact, there's a tremendous amount more in the, you know, in the teachings of the Dharma. And I had sort of started to touch into this place where you can distinguish between your experience and your desire for the experience. Yes. Oftentimes in the Zen tradition, we chant the Prajnaparamita Sutra. And in the beginning of that chant is that Avalokiteshvara, there are lots of interpretation or in translations. When practicing deeply the Prajnaparamita, clearly saw that all five skandhas are empty. And the five skandhas are oftentimes called the aggregates. And their form, which is our body, sensation, which is our embodied, our experience, perception, which is like the lens that we see through of the world, mental formations, which is just our thinking, which is called papancha in Pali, and it means proliferation, like just, and consciousness. And these are called the five skandhas or the five aggregates. And I bring them up because in practice, there's a focus on, like Avalokiteshvara did, in seeing them as empty. And that process is really a process of witnessing that they're not the same thing. We see these things as one thing, and that thing is I, right? Me. I am that thing. When you start to see that they're distinct and empty, then you start to see that there is no I, and no self, no me, in the sense that we think there is. And that's what I mean when I talk about belonging. That in fact, what remains when we let these things that we call self fall away, what remains? Is belonging. In its most intimate way, in its most intimate possible sense. Thank you.
I have a question. You told the story about when your mother told that you hurt her by spending the last family's money on candy. So how does that story relate to you starting practicing Buddhism?
I'm not sure I've ever asked myself that question.
So you were saying that you started using different mechanisms with coping with that, but then those mechanisms often were more destructive. So did that somehow led you to starting like looking at other alternatives? Or
I think fundamentally you're exactly right. Yes. That perhaps it was, I asked myself the question, might there be another way? I've been trying the same thing over and over again and just feeling more and more separated. And you know, when you see someone meditating who has really dropped in, you know, there's an ineffable quality to their presence. So I think that's probably what drew me in, like witnessing something. And Kobun, you know, the teacher who founded this center, witnessing in him this way of being that was unguarded. And honest. Yeah.
I found today's story to be very relaxing because this was something that I addressed in the earlier like short meditation, and just sitting and listening, I caught myself thinking that I was relaxed, and that's actually not that easy to achieve. So thank you.
Thank you.
Could you say in context to this that to boil it down to suffering brought you?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Which is interesting how we call it the first noble truth. Mm-hmm.
I think it was the Thai forest master Ajahn Chah who said if suffering was bad, the Buddha wouldn't have called it a noble truth. He might have called it a truth, but not a noble truth. And in fact, it's not just what brought me to the cushion suffering, but it's what continues to guide me. The suffering. I've come to see the suffering as a lighthouse. You know, when I experience, I'm like, that's where I want to go.
Inescapable.
Yeah.
And for me, resonance and allegory of the physicality, the body, the event of just sitting still, that suffering will arise physically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I've heard this term Dharma used a lot. Can you explain what that is?
Yes, absolutely. So typically two meanings. And in the English alphabet, we distinguish them with a capital D for one and a small d for the other. And dharma is the Sanskrit, and dhamma is the Pali. They essentially both mean the same thing. Actually, I think they both mean exactly the same thing. The lowercase d just means form. In manifestation, anything that exists in this world is a dhamma or a dharma. With a capital D, the dharma is the path, the way, and the teachings. We're blessed to have access to teachings that are 2,600 years old and are still alive. It's not just that people have been reciting them and, you know, writing them down. People have been investigating them and practicing them and questioning them and embodying them. So for me, you know, the Dharma is a living holding of an ancient and profoundly effective practice and teaching.
You feel like Buddhism has any way in connection with psychology? Because I feel like a lot of things like we do Buddhism, like meditation, it's also encouraged or like introduced in psychology. And when we talk about connection or disconnection, that's also a similar concept I've heard in psychology.
Yes, I think that there is a very natural connection. And I would also mention that I'm not a psychologist. So for me, there's a very clear distinction. And I also think that particularly in the domain of trauma, that working with trauma, and especially what the technologies that psychology has developed in recent years around trauma and moving trauma out of our system, that in fact it's in some ways practically identical to meditation practice. I think meditation practice is an ancient technology for clearing trauma. Yes.
Actually, follow up maybe what you were just discussing. What does Buddhism say, or how does it address an untimely death of a child?
Honestly, I think that Buddhism would address it in exactly the same way the grieving mother would, with a broken heart.
What are the mechanisms in Buddhism? So my child is about to die from a incurable brain cancer. So, and you just mentioned earlier that your husband passed away recently. So this is actually the reason why we came here today, three of us, to maybe find some kind of answers or, I don't know, maybe address it in any way.
Yeah. I'm so sorry. I think, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know. I think that there is no easy answer in Buddhism. The only path is through. There's no way around.
Do you know Kisugotami? Can I?
Yes, please.
So there's a very famous story about Kisugotami. Do you know Kisugotami? She hadn't been married for a long time. This is a real woman in the Buddhist time. She hadn't been married, hadn't found the match. She thought she'd never be married. She didn't come from a rich family. And she finally was married to somebody and had a life. And of course, in that era, having a child, a son, was very important. She gave birth to this child and loved her life. She was so grateful. And a child died. And she could not accept this. She walked around with this dead child in her arms for a long time. And she'd go from house to house saying, "Can you help me? Can you help me? Can you help me?" And no one could help her, of course. And they would say kindly, no, I can't help you. No, I can't help you. And finally, some kind villager said, there's a guy in the forest, the Buddha. He might be able to help you. He can help you. She carries her dead child to the Buddha. And the Buddha says, yeah, I can help you. And he said, go into the village with your baby. Go to every house until you can find a mustard seed. One mustard seed from a house that has not suffered this loss, a loss like this, who has not suffered like this. And she goes, great. She takes the baby, she goes to town. She goes from house to house to house, and everyone says, I don't have that mustard seed because I too, everyone. She finally understands. She comes back with the baby to the Buddha. She's able to let go. Story. That was the lunch bell.
That was the lunch bell.
Any other urgent questions? You can see him at lunchtime too.
Yes, Randy.
Yeah. When I think of the Dharma, there's one level that you talked about, all the teachings from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years from different cultures and scenarios and whatnot. And then I also think of the Dharma as something very individualized from day to day, as we make mistakes and we do this and we do that. And even people that aren't Buddhists, they're experiencing this Dharma of just trying to figure out life. But what I have trouble with sometimes is that gap between reading about something from long ago from people in a certain context, even in a monastic bubble of some kind, where they're just, and then to my own life, my own world situations and stuff I see in the world today, and trying to make that, I guess sometimes I have a hard time making that leap. And sometimes I'll read something, I hear something like, wow, yeah. But a lot of it is just I don't know. Yeah, I just have a hard time relating to it, I guess. I can read it and kind of understand it intellectually, but bringing it into my own life is not always easy. So that's my question is, I don't know what my question is, but
was everybody able to hear?
Yeah. It's that gap.
Yeah. Mm. I think for me, yeah, I think for me, you're speaking to what is sometimes called a spiritual bypass, where we try and put ourselves into this bubble of Buddhism that's separated from the rest of the world. And I think that the truth of Buddhism is really that that there is absolutely no separation. And I think it is very important as Buddhists for us to be engaged in the world, especially now in these times. Yeah. And that, you know, this is the what you brought up is something we could talk about for and explore for a long time. And in fact, it is my job running the Rocky Mountain Eco Dharma Retreat Center, which is a very engaged Buddhist community. So I think I would say that there are lots of opportunities as well throughout to practice engaged Buddhism. And I'm a champion for engaged Buddhism.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.